Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to The Cinema Clash. I am Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net, joined as always by Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com, safely entrenched in his basement about 2 miles down the road as we continue to social distance. Hey there, Charlie.
Hannah, we're on the precipice of July. And I remember back in February, March, when all of this kicked off and our quarantine streams began, July was supposed to be, over. Like, we were supposed to be not necessarily back in theaters, but we could have at least shared a basement again and conducted a proper podcast. But here it is, just about July, and things are, they're just as bad. Certain states have misbehaved, certain patterns of behavior became patterns too soon. The political drama is not necessarily political comedy, but it's almost farcical sometimes. And it's very timely because we get a political comedy this week, one that we would have seen on the big screen. This has heavy-hitting actors. This has a heavy-hitting director. This comedy we would have seen in a theater together, and I think it would have sparked something here in D.C. What am I talking about here with the movie Irresistible?
I think you're talking about a comedy that unfortunately is just not funny enough to sustain. And I think we've got so much going on politically around us that it's just a little more difficult to watch something like Irresistible. It was just not as good as I had hoped. It's not the escape we sort of need right now. But basically, in a nutshell, it is really a scathing rebuke of our campaign finance system issued through the lens of political satire. You've got Steve Carell playing this guy named Gary Zimmer. He's a Democratic political strategist based in D.C. He travels out to the small Wisconsin town of Deerlocken to help a retired Marine colonel, played by Chris Cooper, who I love, who's running for mayor, to sort of get him to run for mayor, because this character, this political strategist, Gary, sees this guy as being some sort of redder kind of blue, somebody that could potentially straddle the Democrat and the Republican spectrum and beat the Republican incumbent. And so that really is what sparks this sort of what becomes a spectacle in the town of Deerlocken, as you have political strategists from both sides sort of trying to turn Deerlocken into what is, I think, a microcosm of everything that's going on in our election world at large.
Yeah, movie audiences had lofty expectations for this film because it is written and directed by Jon Stewart. Yes, that Jon Stewart from The Daily Show. This is his wheelhouse. He knows politics. He knows comedy. Put the two together, and this should be gold, Jerry. This is Stewart's second directorial effort after 2014's Rosewater, which I really appreciated. It kind of disappeared, but I thought it was a great, very good first try at a feature film. And his second try with Irresistible is, it feels obsolete on arrival. Yes, campaign finance is still a ripe fruit for picking, but you know who does it better? Documentaries do it better. Mm-hmm. And there's room to make fun of it. Our campaign finance laws are funny at times. They're so funny it hurts. But it also has a misleading trailer. You watch the trailer and it looks like Steve Carell versus Rose Byrne, Democrat versus Republican. And it's not, actually. She's a very supporting character. The main crux of this film is Steve Carell, city slicker from D.C., who cannot find his footing in a small town, who makes a joke of himself. He just can't get it right. He can't connect with real blue-collar people in flyover country. And the jokes that they try to make about that are just not funny. They land with a thud. I didn't laugh at them. He's this Doc Hollywood type, and none of it works.
Well, and you mentioned how it would be better served as a documentary. And it felt to me like this was a dramatized version of a documentary. Like if you took a Michael Moore documentary and you turned it into a political satire, comedy, drama, or whatever, that's sort of what this felt like. But it might work as an extended segment of The Daily Show. Or you probably don't remember Michael Moore's satirical TV news magazine show from the 1990s, but he had this show called TV Nation, and it had some just zingers and absolutely great political satire. And so this would have been like a great half hour segment on something like this. But I think what happens is because it does not work as a 2 hour film, it drags so much in the middle. And so you just don't know how you're supposed to feel about these characters. It has some really funny laugh out loud moments, but then it has some real misfires too. And in the end, it's really all about just sort of trying to, to promote outrage about our, election system. And the election economy, I think, is how John Stewart refers to it. And so I really wanted this film to be so much more than it was. It's just disappointing. It's not that it's terrible. It's just not even close to what I was hoping for.
It's not terrible. It's safe. It's so safe. It's benign. It's more rom-com than anything biting like black humor, like satire. It never pushes any sort of edge to be that you can refer to it as satire. You know, it makes fun of CNN and Fox News and sound bites. And I thought the first 4 or 5 minutes of this film had so much promise. I was exciting. It takes place on election night, and you have Steve Carell and Rose Byrne and their respective cameras saying, "I'm lying to you. You know I'm lying to you, and you're here listening to me anyway." So he's poking at the media, but it doesn't go anywhere, and it goes so far downhill after that. And some awesome supporting actors and actresses that I love pop up in small, do-nothing, mm-hmm. what-are-you-doing-here roles like Topher Grace and Natasha Lyonne. Natasha Lyonne, who just had her own Netflix series, Russian Doll, where she was in every scene for like 10 episodes and it was awesome, is in this thankless, ridiculous role. And what is she doing here?
Yeah, and I think I remember like Deborah Messing popped up in the beginning and was hysterical. I loved her character, and then you never saw her again. And to me, that was a missed opportunity. I'm like, there were some, cameo minor roles that should have been blown up into something more because those characters were fun. And this is just, it's John Stewart trying to get a message out, which I get. His message is a valid one, but it's just in case you didn't get it at the end. And there's a bit of a twist, it's like, okay, if you still don't get it, during the credit roll, let me just spell it out for you a little more. And you've got this round table of talking media, of media talking heads who are mocking their own role in the campaign game. And then you've got John Stewart off camera interviewing a real former chairman of the FCC about the failures across every single part of the system and how unlikely it is to change. And so in the end, that's kind of a downer when we don't need a downer right now.
And you don't, I can't really think of a true hard-hitting, great political comedy. I mean, maybe The Big Short, maybe, but they usually just play it so safe. Like, you remember long time ago, Michael Keaton and Gina Davis in Speechless, then there was Welcome to Mooseport. I mean, political comedies can be so saccharine, and this is just, I believe, just falls right into that category, even though it's also got heavy-hitting production. This is Plan B Entertainment. That's Brad Pitt's company.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, no,
you can see this on what they now call Movies on Demand. Movies on Demand is now a catch-all for Amazon, Apple, DirecTV, and Fandango for $19.99.
That's right. And I think Xfinity and Google Play as well. So so you'll find it if you want to see it. And I do think that that fans of The Daily Show, the people who just miss that sort of Jon Stewart and Steve Carell combo, they're probably going to seek it out. And maybe not everyone will be as disappointed as us. I just think they just will definitely need to keep their expectations in check.
The best political comedy of the year so far are the first 5 minutes of Irresistible. All right, our next film is brought to you by Doritos. And you will know what I mean if you go out and see My Spy. My Spy wants to be 2020's kindergarten cop. Dave Bautista is playing Arnold Schwarzenegger. Here he's a CIA super agent who must infiltrate a family to get to the real bad guy. Kind of like Schwarzenegger had to infiltrate a kindergarten class and a family to get to the bad guy. Directed by Peter Siegel. Now, Peter Siegel is like this everyman of comedy, lowbrow comedies. Every now he hits. He hit with Get Smart and 51st Dates. Those were outstanding. And way back in the day, I mean, to me, he did Tommy Boy, one of the most quotable comedies continued to this day. But he also is, you know, a blue-collar comedy director. If you remember Grudge Match, the remake of The Longest Yard.
No.
Perhaps.
Skip that.
Perhaps. And I'm not here for Dave Bautista. He is so wooden. He acts like a 2x4. What really saves My Spy from being just bottom of the barrel, it's not. It's kind of almost middle of the barrel. Almost. Is little Chloe Coleman. This little 9-year-old is so versatile and gives such a remarkable children's performance with, you know, terrible dialogue and terrible situation comedy. But I found the child actor in this film quite believable, Hannah.
Yeah, she's from Big Little Lies on TV. So folks might know her from that. But yeah, she plays this precocious kid who threatens to blow the CIA agent's cover unless he teaches her the tricks of his trade. And so that's really what triggers all of your comedy and drama. And you talk about how this character is could be Arnold Schwarzenegger. It also could be easily Dwayne The Rock Johnson in his early roles, John Cena. I mean, I feel like I've seen all of these guys. You pair them with a clever kid and you know exactly
John
what
Cena
you're...
John Cena in that stupid Fireman movie. Yeah.
Right, which, you know, exactly, that your kid loved all the poop jokes. And so I do think I kind of felt like any of them could be in the Dave Bautista role. I only think of Dave Bautista really from Guardians of the Galaxy, the big burly dude. You know, the plot has so many holes, it's hysterical to me, but it's held together though with this combination of corny and funny and poignant moments, and, you know, and it's got enough mayhem perpetrated by kids and adults to just kind of keep the action going. And, the plot was something weird. It was just like, the guy has to go and guard the widow and kid of somebody who apparently had plotted to build a nuclear weapon. I never really understood what the plot was going for. But the bottom line is that the Dave Bautista character, JJ, ends up breaking the cardinal rule of surveillance, which is don't get involved with the people you're supposed to be surveilling, even if they're smart and cute. And of course, that's what happens. And I this was the very last film that I saw in an actual movie theater. So I saw this movie way back in early March. And I never would have thought when I left the theater that evening that this film would actually not even be available to the public for several more months because of the pandemic. And now here it is. Available exclusively on Amazon Prime Video now, and apparently in a few random drive-ins. So if you go to myspy.movie, you might actually you can find a list of the random drive-ins that this film will be playing in as well.
The plot is just a mechanism to get Dave Bautista and the kid in more scenes together. That's really 80% of this film is the adult and child, you know, kind of sparring with each other. She pushes him and he eventually acquiesces and backs off. You know, his main problem in the beginning is he's a soldier and he lacks spycraft because that requires finesse and emotional intelligence, none of which he is capable of. And, you know, in the last film, Irresistible, we talked about throwaway roles for Topher Grace and Natasha Lyonne. The throwaway role here is for Ken Jeong. He pops up once at the beginning and once at the end and cashes his paycheck is how bad that comes off. I didn't really love it, but she does the best she can is Kristen Schaal. Kristen Schaal has, you know, she voices a character on Bob's Burgers and she was on Flight of the Conchords. She's really funny and she does her best as, you know, the computer hacker, the analyst who calls herself the spy's, you know, partner in the field, which she's not. She wants, you know, she wants him to teach her how to use weaponry and knives and guns while he's, you know, she's jealous of the 9-year-old because she's learning that stuff. And she goes as far as she can with it. And she didn't hurt the film. She helped it as much as she could. But really, this is stock material of, you know, that odd match pairing of kid with authority figure. And at least, did you notice their little motif? They were making fun. They were somewhat mocking action films. You know, they were practicing the last line the hero's supposed to say. They were doing the slow walk away from the explosion. And even the forced reference to Raiders of the Lost Ark that almost hit.
Yeah, no, and that's just, they were cute moments. They were funny. You got it. You saw what they were doing. And it needed to do that because it needed to really mock itself in some ways because it is a stock. We've seen this all before. But as I said with, you know, the problem with The Irresistible is you're not going to get that escape that we kind of are all needing right now. And My Spy, I think, for family viewing is that escape film that some people are going to be perfectly happy to just be able to watch and enjoy. Even if you forget it 10 minutes later, you'll have enjoyed it in the moment enough. And I think there's something to be said for that. So if you have Amazon Prime Video, you know, hey, check it out. What else have we got on tap?
Well, easier to watch is, you know, a lot of people, even if you have Amazon, you still have to pay for some of these really big, big movies. They don't just pop down to you for free on Amazon Video, but they do on Netflix. And we do have one of those this week on Netflix, and it's a new Will Ferrell. Now, Will Ferrell, he's got a niche. What he does is he likes to make fun of a particular slice of life. Remember, he made fun of ice skating or ice dancing, figure skating in Blades of Glory. He made fun of NASCAR in Talladega Nights, The Ballad of Ricky Bobby, and he made fun of 1970s, you know, newsrooms and media and journalists with Anchorman, both Anchormans, in fact, and now he's back. He's making fun of something again. He's making fun of something maybe a lot of Americans don't know about. You do know about it if you've ever lived in Europe or you watch interesting channels, but it's something that's more popular today than it has ever been, and it's the Eurovision Song Contest. Hannah, can you tell us why or what and how Will Ferrell is making fun of the Eurovision Song Contest, the story of Fire Saga?
I love that this film does not pretend to be anything more than what it is. It is a campy slice of goofy escapism. Yes, it pays tribute to this worldwide phenomenon that the U.S. has just been remarkably slow to embrace and should. But Will Ferrell, I guess his wife is from Sweden, and so he'd spend the summers there, and he and his family would actually have these watch parties of Eurovision Song Contest. And so he just immediately was like, how are we not doing some film about this? So he spotted the just the ingredients for a perfect role for himself. And so he does. He crafts this role for himself. And any film to me that starts with Pierce Brosnan and ABBA singing Waterloo and is not Mamma Mia has something going for it automatically. And so I had fun with this film. I had never really heard much about the ins and outs of the Eurovision Song Contest, but now I am so excited to see it next time it does roll around. And so to learn that this song contest has been around since 1956, spans more than 40 countries, not just European, and it launched the careers of ABBA in 1974 with Waterloo and Celine Dion in 1988. I just did not know this stuff. And so now, thanks to Will Ferrell and his summer trips to Sweden, I'm really glad that I just sort of have this quirky international event to look forward to in the future when they're able to restart this competition.
I did know most of those, you know, trivia facts about the Eurovision, and I've seen an entire Eurovision cycle before when it was hosted by Azerbaijan, and they said the production is really good. I mean, you think American Idol can be suspenseful? Europe, they have got this down to a science. And unfortunately, I didn't like this movie at all. I didn't laugh. I barely chuckled. You know, it's talk about stock. So Will Ferrell and Rachel McAdams, Lars and Sigrid are from a very, very, very small fishing village in Iceland. And that's most of the jokes from the first hour, just these little from nowhere Iceland jokes. And his dreams are greater than his reality. He wants to be an international pop superstar ever since he saw ABBA, to prove to his father, Pierce Brosnan, that, you know, he's not the failure that his father thinks he is. You know, there's themes like you're solely focused on your goal and you're ignoring the romance right under your nose. It's not that there's a Russian singer, there's a Greek singer, you know, everyone pops up, and it's not, of course, the two wannabe lovers, you think they're lovers, then they get in a fight, and the whole cycles of ups and downs, nadirs and troughs. Director David Dobkin, his resume is all over the map. We saw him last in 2014 in The Judge. Remember Robert Downey Jr. in The Judge? And he's done
Robert Duvall. I love that film.
Some throwaway comedy chaff like The Change Up and Fred Claus. But he's the Wedding Crashers guy. He's done The Wedding Crashers. So he's got that under his belt. He knows how to do this. But perhaps he forgot how to do this.
Oh, see, I totally disagree. I think it's exactly what he was going for. I think you're just missing it. You're missing the fun in this. And there are some stupid elements to it. I mean, there's like this really weird running joke. It's because it's Lars Eriksson, and Sigrid's last name is Eric's daughter. And so people ask if they're brother and sister, and there's like a running joke.
And that's funny. The first two or three times, it's funny, but it's not funny.
But when you throw away like, oh, there's a Russian, there's a Greek. It's like,
That's the supporting chaff.
The scene stealer in this film, in my book, is the Chechen Russian contestant, Alexander Lemtov, who is played by Dan Stevens, who is from Downton Abbey, but also the live action Beauty and the Beast. So he's got singing talent, and he is, he portrays this Russian George Michael. He's got looks, money, this kind of raw sensuality, and this very quirky performance style that blends pop and opera. And he sings this song like Lion of Love. And I enjoyed the music, and there are some catchy tunes in here. I thought the cast was actually quite charming. There's a quirkiness throughout this film that's deliberate, and it's mocking and celebrating at the same time.
It's mocking music, but it's not like a mockumentary, like, you know, A Mighty Wind.
No.
It's like a Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story. And you know, some of the performances are catchy. I could see, you know, maybe this soundtrack taking off a little bit if people, you know, really snap their fingers to it. But it's so campy and slapstick at times. You know, Fire Saga just cannot get it together on stage. Usually something happens like that, what happened to Spinal Tap, just something ridiculous, you know, falling off the wire, just ridiculous costumes. And it's just, that's not witty. That's chuckles at
but
most.
But that is this competition, and that's why I'm looking forward to seeing it. It was supposed to be held in the Netherlands and like around now, and this film was supposed to be released in conjunction with the 2020 Eurovision Song Contest. And so because it was canceled due to the pandemic, you know, it loses some of that opportunity to really sort of connect those dots for people to really understand that this is a very unusual competition. It's always held, it's held every year in the country. The host country is the country that actually won the previous year. And so I guess in 2019, it was someone from the Netherlands who won. And so they were supposed to host it, which means it'll be very interesting to see how they adjust to this glitch in their normal way of doing this competition every year. But it's filmed on location in the UK and in Iceland, and I enjoyed some of that. But you know, the Nordic stuff's pretty funny. I just enjoyed it. It was again a 2-hour escape, and I think people who like watching musical competition shows are going to just enjoy this for what it is. It's quintessential Will Ferrell type of material. And so you just take it for what it is and nothing more. And I think you can enjoy it.
I would have enjoyed it more if it was more 95 minutes than a full 2 hours.
That's true.
It's just not as funny as Anchorman or Talladega Nights. It's not. And
no, that's true.
You're right about the tie-in. This probably would have made this year's Eurovision so much more absorbable by an American audience who I don't know if they would turn in, though, because they're not eligible to participate in it. But people love reality contest shows. Americans do. And maybe they would have grasped onto it. But this is middle tier Will Ferrell and Rachel McAdams. It's actually reminded me a bit of her Pitch Perfect stuff. You know, they have a song along about halfway through. People just break out in song and it's perfect. Reminded me of when Pitch Perfect breaks out into acapella stuff. And I remember Elizabeth, yeah. You know, I know that's Elizabeth Banks and this is Rachel McAdams, but it's very similar.
And I do agree with you that it should have been around nine. They should have targeted it for that 95 minute mark. I think that would have been better. It does go on a little longer than it needs to, but the music is what saves it for me, because that's what I was watching it for, was this sort of very quirky, Britain's Got Talent / American Idol kind of vibe. And again, I learned something. It made me go and read up more. And I'm seeing all this additional material come out this week, all these other stories with more background on the Eurovision Song Contest. And so I think in some ways the film is succeeding in doing what it always wanted to do again, which is just celebrating this competition that really features an eclectic mix of people, and to try and get Americans to sort of realize what they've been missing, because Europeans really do know about this competition and do have those viewing parties. It's like their Super Bowl viewing party. And so I look forward to someday just having getting folks together and just being like, let's check out this Eurovision Song Contest.
You know, you mentioned eclectic musicians and Americans missing something. And it reminds me of how we began this week, actually, which was finishing up last week's AFI Docs Film Festival. And the closing film of that film festival was Jimmy Carter, Rock and Roll President. I brag to my wife, who was born under Reagan, that, yeah, I was born under Carter, because I was born like right before that election. So yeah, I was totally born under Carter. And I didn't know that he had these, you know, this really intimate connection with Dylan and Willie Nelson and the Allman Brothers. And it shows that in this documentary about, you know, he had concerts at the White House and now they hung out and they just got each other. And he was a soulful guy. And that Carter, he's not in the history books very much, not like his successor and couple predecessors were. And what the takeaway I had from this film was, history's going to look very kindly at Jimmy Carter. You know, it's going to come full circle and be like, you know what? You didn't know what you had. And this guy was he was dealt a raw deal. He had some bad cards to play, but man, he was, you guys enjoy your 4 years with that one. Did you like that Jimmy Carter as much as I did?
I did. I really enjoyed it. I had some technical difficulties trying to watch it when it was rolling through the AFI Docs virtual festival, but eventually they got all that stuff figured out. And then I tuned into the post-screening Q&A, and Jimmy Carter's like 94 now, called in and from Plains, Georgia, and there were technical glitches there too, but it was just so sweet to kind of just hear him talk about the film and the filmmakers and praising them. And it just makes you appreciate Carter even more, because here's a guy that has just done more in service for our country and the world since leaving office in 1980 than really anybody. And I was alive through his presidency.
Me too.
Yeah, but a little older than you. And so I remember the Iran hostage crisis and all of that pretty very well. And he did, he did get a raw deal, because I think what this documentary does really show is that this is just a genuine guy. He's so genuine and everything's heartfelt. And even for those of us who were aware of Carter and his presidency, I don't know many people who are familiar with really just how much of a love of music and knowledge of music across all these genres that he actually had.
And no, I had no idea. I can understand that he would have been a Willie Nelson fan, but jazz. He had, yeah, you know, Dizzy Gillespie at the White House a whole bunch, and Thelonious Monk popped up, and I was very taken with it. Like, wow, you know, you're not just like rock and roll. There's jazz, there's R&B, there's a lot of gospel, because, you know, he's a church-going man. He has a lot of gospel. And so I was very, very impressed by that. And, you know, you only hear... Not, it's not bad stuff, but you only hear knocks against Carter about the Iran hostage crisis. And I didn't realize that, of course, the easiest thing in the world to do, and any other president probably would have done, was dropped bombs on Iran. And he was like, no, I will not do that, because they will kill the hostages. And, you know, even though Reagan is given the credit that they all came home on Inauguration Day, they all came home alive. They all came home alive because of Carter.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. And so I love that Jimmy Carter, rock and roll president, it gives him a little more of his due. And I love learning that the Allman Brothers were probably just hugely influential in getting him elected, which I just had no idea. But it was just great to learn. And, you know, with this particular film, as AFI Docs, you know, often does, is they just closed out on what is truly a high note. And so I think this was just a good choice for a closing documentary.
You know, full circle, your girl Linda Ronstadt comes off actually not looking that good. You know, she had a good documentary last year, but here she mm-hmm. is supporting Jerry Brown along with the Eagles. Yeah. And I'm like, oh man, if the Eagles are playing for you, I ain't going to vote for you. That's
right. There's some funny stuff about just how much music influenced that election. And so again, I love documentaries where you just sort of learn something you never even realized or heard about before. And so it certainly delivered on that.
The other tentpole that we saw before closing night was called Rebuilding Paradise. And it's from a director we all know. It's from Ron Howard. Ron Howard, and he is, you know, if you not realize it, a prolific documentary filmmaker. You've talked about him before with Pavarotti. He did a Beatles documentary, 8 days a week, and he's back. He saw the pictures and the video coming out of Paradise, California, when the town was completely on fire and burned to the ground, and he got up there immediately to watch the aftermath. And this kind of takes place, you know, 365 days afterwards. And while the documentary didn't really strike the biggest chord with me, what did was the footage that came out of mm-hmm. the fire. You know, that town burned to the ground during the day, like 10 in the morning, noon, 2 in the afternoon. And it's the darkest thing I've ever seen. It's pitch black. And I have a feeling, I think you like this film a little bit more than I did.
Well, it's not whether it's more or less. It was just that Ron Howard always delivers a well-paced documentary, and he's always got good characters. He just knows how to look for that. And so I think that's what comes across. But it is. It's the footage. It's the cell phone footage that these people had from fleeing the fires. And you just feel the burn. It's like, oh my gosh, to just realize what they were going through was crazy. And so, you know, we follow this group of residents for like a full year as they're trying to rebuild their homes and community and dealing with the bureaucracy and FEMA and all this stuff and coping with the trauma of what they just lost and grieving, you know, a lot of people who died. But ultimately what I liked about it, it's just meant is this tribute of resilience in the face of uncertainty. And I think it speaks well for our time right now and helps put things into perspective. I mean, imagine facing the pandemic so soon after you've just dealt with rebuilding from that disaster. Can't even imagine the kids who were not able to go to school in their own schools for so long. And then, you know, that was recent. And so for this to, you know, for the current coronavirus stuff to be happening on the heels of that, it just makes me sort of feel like, okay, I can handle this because I still have a roof over my head. All my possessions didn't burn to the ground a year ago. I didn't, you know, it just, to me, the resilience and of community is just a really good message right now that I think is just a good one that resonates.
Yeah, that's a good tie-in. I don't remember the distribution on this, whether it's going to pop up on PBS or whatever, get in a theatrical run, but I expect for it to get an audience just because of who the director is. It's going to get
absolutely
seen. And,
Yeah,
it was good to see, you know, the Q&A section of like the principal who's still got high school graduation to go and the first guy to like build his house back.
Paradise, Ron Howard in his living room. You know, it's just kind of those Q&As. That's just kind of fun that they pulled it off to do this virtual documentary festival and to still have these Q&As. It had, you know, of course, there are always going to be technical issues, but some of them really flowed pretty smoothly. And it was kind of fun to just realize that you were sitting there watching a live stream of these people in their home environment, and to see somebody like Ron Howard and his daughter had done one the night before following her documentary Dads. And so it was kind of fun to see what, you know, you kind of look at the backgrounds and go, okay, what kind of room are they sitting in right now? And so to see Ron Howard do that was just an interesting twist to a documentary festival, very different from the docs, AFI docs we've had in the past.
Yeah, Ron Howard has a nice living room. You can just tell. everything is going to stay virtual, at least for the foreseeable future, because, you know, things they're getting worse again. The curve's going back up. That means movie theaters are indefinitely postponed. And the biggest tent poles of the summer, Christopher Nolan's Tenet and the live action remake of Mulan, have once again been pushed back. They were going to come out in July. Obviously, July movie theaters are not going to happen. So now they're saying, okay, maybe late August. I wouldn't cash in that lottery ticket either. My initial reaction, though, is, and give me your opinion on this, Mulan. Well, I get keeping Tenet under wraps. No, you know, that's supposedly so amazing, you need to release that on the globe at once over 24 hours on an IMAX screen. But Mulan, why can you not open Mulan in other countries? Because it's not like spoilers are a problem.
That's right. Yeah, no, I agree. I can't imagine that that there's any real valid reason other than the studios just holding on to hope that that they would be able to have that massive global rollout. But I think Mulan is a perfect example of one that you should be able to roll out in whatever theaters around the world happen to be open. And I honestly think it would be perfectly fine to probably release it on demand as well. And then if kids really embrace it, then when it comes out in the theater, they'll go and watch it in a theater if they can. But I don't see the point in trying to pretend that that one would be something that just absolutely has to be seen, you know, in the same vein as a Christopher Nolan epic film that probably does require a huge screen and immersion. Mulan to me just is not an immersive, necessary kind of film.
No, not at all. And I know Disney sunk hundreds of millions of dollars, and they're just, you know, what are we going to do to get that money back? I don't know if you do actually get hundreds of millions of dollars from an on-demand cable release. Maybe you do. I mean, Disney Plus, I have no idea how much money they make. Maybe they are raking that in hand over fist, but I doubt it. And even the other country this would play in, China, you know, they delayed their movie theaters as well since they got hit again. They're not, I think only right now you could open it in New Zealand and maybe Scandinavia. That's about it.
Well, and I'll tell you what I really liked about this week compared to our previous several weeks is we had three real movies. I felt that we had three real movies to watch, and they were all streaming in some capacity. And so it was the first time in quite a while that I was like, wow, these are like real movies we're talking about that a lot of people will have access to and choices that they will be able to make. And so to me, that was sort of the closest I've felt in quite a while to feeling that we actually did have multiple releases in a given week to talk about. And so I think the fact that, you know, I thought they were different, and certainly,
you know, it's not that we talk about fake movies.
No,
these are three Hannah movies. These are three mainstream exactly. Hannah movies, which is why I actually can't pick a best film of the week because I didn't see one. I didn't see a best film. Of the week.
I saw three movies this week,
but they're all comparably missable, if you know what I mean. Missable.
Yes, I think under normal circumstances, if they had been in the theater and we had gone and seen them in the theater, I would have said yes, they are all totally forgettable. But I think that for our time, it's. They're still somewhat worth seeing. I think there will be an audience for all of these, but I agree. It's a toss-up. I think that you're going to get the political satire people who are going to watch Irresistible no matter what, because they've been looking forward to it, and the trailer will have gotten them thinking that they were in for some really riotous political comedy that they will then probably be somewhat disappointed. My Spy, I think if you're looking for something to just take a 10, you know, watch with your a 10-year-old or to have a viewing party in the garage, you know, in the backyard with some neighborhood kids, I think My Spy is your go-to. And then Eurovision Song Contest is just going to be for people like me who just like music and film, almost irregardless of the plot and the story, which in this case is completely silly with Eurovision Song Contest. But again, I just I was just happy to have three things that I didn't hate, which is always, you know, that's a 3 out of 3 for serviceable streaming film fare. I think is makes for a decent week.
You know, I watched My Spy with my 7-year-old, and there's some language in there, and there's some jokes, and there's some real off-color jokes in there. And I was looking at him, like, oh, did he understand that? Is he going to tell his mom that joke later? And no, he didn't, but I got away with it. But I think I'd go. My Spy is for 9-year-olds and above. Don't take your 7-year-old to see My Spy.
No, that's why I said I think I went with 10.
You did, absolutely.
You know, around the 10-year-old. So again, yeah, I think it's probably there,
seven's year and a half too young.
That's right. So, all right. So, you know, we've given people their fair warning, but, you know, watch the trailer, look at the ratings, and use your best judgment. But basically, so I think that's a good note to end on. So that'll do it for this edition of the Cinema Clash. Thanks for tuning in. I am Hannah Buchdahl on behalf of myself and my co-host, Charlie Jewell. Stay safe, wear a mask, wash your hands, and have a great week.
Thank you.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.